Just after 9 o'clock on a Saturday morning, and that must mean it's time again for Money Management with Opus 111 Group's Mike Mayo. Money, 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 money. Here's Mike.
Hey, good morning and happy Saturday. This is Jim Harvey, president of Opus 111 Group, and I'm substituting for your regular host, Mike Mayo, who's senior vice president of our firm and oversees our Spokane branch. In a few minutes, I'm going to turn things over to my son, Andrew Harvey, will provide you with key market closing data after Friday's close. If you have any questions you'd like us to address in future money management shows, please email them to info@opus111group.com, and we will either answer them directly or during next week's show. We encourage and invite you to visit our website for the latest on the markets, listen to our video and audio podcasts, and our perspectives on how you can manage your portfolio in a way that enhances your ability to achieve your financial goals and live the life you imagine. I will be back after Andrew's market closing data report with some key economic news for the past week. Then after a commercial break, I will discuss three important topics for anyone who wants to sleep more soundly at night and make the most of your portfolio's return. The first is a question that we get from our clients that a lot of folks in our business do not easily answer. Namely, how come my portfolio isn't tracking the S&P 500, the Dow Jones, or the Russell 3000, or some other stock index? And I'll show you why that's the wrong question to ask. Number two is why index investing has serious flaws and isn't the silver bullet that so many pundits and large investment houses like Schwab, Vanguard, or Fidelity advocate so strongly. And then three, what we think you should do now, given what's going on in the market today. And now I'll turn things over to Andrew, who will give you the closing market data for the week ending Friday, August 11th. Andrew?
Thanks for that, Jim. Taking a look at the S&P 500, it finishes the week a little under flat, down 0.6%. Took a big jump on Monday, a 0.9, but was down pretty much the rest of the days, 0.42 on Tuesday, 0.7% on Wednesday, and 0.11% on Friday, with just a 0.03 bump on Thursday. So overall, pretty flat week, trending down slightly. Looking at some of the other major indices, like we said, the S&P 500 down slightly on the week, but having a good 2023 so far, up 16.73% so far this year. It's up 4.3% from where it was 1 year ago. The Dow Jones finished the week at 35,281.4. That's up 6.4% this year and up 4.5% from this time in 2022. The NASDAQ up 31.36% so far in 2023, but still also just 4.5% from where it was a year ago. The Russell 2000 bucks the trend while keeping right on that 4.5% figure. It's down 4.5% from where it was in 2022, up just under 10% on the year. Over in the UK, the FTSE down 0.5% so far this year, up a little over a quarter of a percentage point from 1 year ago. The Nikkei index in Japan is up 26.25% so far in 2023, up 13.76% from where it was this time last year. Crude oil continuing to slide after that spike in energy prices. It's up 8% on the year, but it is down 9.5% from where it was in 2022. Gold, still just reliable and doing its thing, up 3.62% and up 5.8% from where it was last year. And finally, the 10-year Treasury up 10%, well, 9.9% so far this year in 2023, but up 46.3%. No surprises there with the rate hike cycle. Back to you, Jim.
Thanks, Andrew. And now for some economic news. Friday's job report could provide a crucial piece to the increasingly complicated puzzle that is the U.S. economy and its long-anticipated slide into recession. Now, we at Opus don't believe that we're going to have a recession, or if we do, it'd be extremely mild. But the 187,000 increase in non-farm payrolls, it was below the number that people thought. And June, they expected the numbers they saw a gain of 209,000, and year to date it's about $1.7 million new jobs. Now, slower job growth might fit the narrative that we're heading for a contraction, But other data, like the GDP, productivity, consumer spending, have been surprisingly strong lately. And that could leave the payrolls number as a key arbiter for whether the economy is headed for a downturn. And if the Fed Reserve continues to keep rising interest rates to control inflation, that is still running well above the central bank's target. So to me, the key to focus on when you're looking at the jobs report is what they call the prime age participation rate, which I'll refer to a little bit later in the show. But that is the age group of 25 to 54 year old employees. While the overall participation rate of all ages has been stuck at about 62% for the past 4 months and is still below its pre-pandemic level, the prime age group that we were just talking about has been moving up steadily, if incrementally, and is currently at 83.5%, half a percentage point above where it was in February of 2020, just before the COVID hit. Now, that tells me that we're doing pretty darn well. But, you know, it's interesting. People on Wall Street and the economists and the chief equity strategists all have gotten in their mind that we're going to be into a recession. It's got to happen. You know, we have an inverted yield curve, blah, 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 blah. But I think they may be just wrong. Now, let's take a look at inflation. After a year of monthly declines, the year-over-year inflation rate has risen from 3% to 3.2%, still well above the Federal Reserve target of 2%. But far below where it peaked out at 6 and 7%. This increase is partly due to the way energy costs are accounted for in the report, as year-over-year inflation no longer reflects the dramatic climb from peak prices in June of 2022, when average gas prices hit $5 a gallon. While rising oil prices are an ever-present concern, recent energy price increases have been amplified in the year-over-year numbers, says Kurt Rankin, a senior economist at PNC Financial Services Group. Similarly, housing costs have cooled in 2023, but there are serious delays in the way that data is represented in the Labor Bureau reports. Moderating prices for houses and rent are expected to help lower core inflation in future CPI reports, but those early increases in 2020 and 2021 are still actually being incorporated into the data. So the Fed is looking to core inflation, which measures the price of all goods and services, excluding volatile food and energy prices. Core inflation continued to cool by 0.2% as it did in June, after 6 months of increases of closer to 0.4%. That's a good rate in terms of taming inflation. And in June, Fed Chair Jerome Powell said that he didn't anticipate core inflation returning to the central bank's 2% target until 2025. I think that's very critical because bottom line, we need the Fed to stop hiking. We think that there might be one more hike in November, but after that, I think they're just going to step aside and let the economy do what it's going to do. In this segment, I want to go over a question that everybody naturally asks themselves, and I want to explain why I don't think you should bother. And that has to do with looking at your portfolio and wondering, well, why doesn't my portfolio keep track with some stock market index like the S&P 500 or the Russell 3000, et cetera, et cetera? And this is a really good question. I mean, it's completely normal and understandable to ask that question. But when you delve into it a little bit more, it's the kind of wrong question to ask. And this is why I wrote a white paper several years ago explaining this in great detail. So if you would like a copy of that, please send us an email at info@opus111group.com and we will get back to you with a copy of this white paper that I wrote in 2019. You know, I've been in the business 41 years and I realized that this question is a very important question that clients have asked and we haven't really done as an industry a good job of answering. Now, there are a number of reasons why your portfolio wouldn't track the S&P 500, for example. One of the most profound differences is something to do with how performance is reported by indices and managers and ETF managers, mutual fund managers, institutional separate account managers track performance, and how we report performance to you on our various reports, or just by looking at your statement month after month. And that has to do with the difference between time-weighted and dollar-weighted return. So understanding the difference between these two different methodologies is important. Now, you know, you'd like the answer to this be simple. Unfortunately, like a lot of things in life, a complete and comprehensive answer is far more nuanced. You know, I've been a guest lecturer at Stanford University for 25 years. And one of the things that you think about is, okay, what are some of the differences for that? But let's take with a time-weighted and dollar-weighted return basis. And this white paper I referred to really goes into great depth and shows you how these things are different. But the basic difference is that index, for example, reports the performance of the index in its entirety, but it does not take into account when people put money in and when people take money out. And it makes sense that they just look at, you know, the performance of the stocks in the index over a period of time, and what did it do from point A to point B? And that could be a month, it could be a quarter, it could be a year, it could be 5 years. But none of those things really have anything to do with the investment decisions of investors. And that makes sense, because when you think about it, you wouldn't want the performance of an index or a manager, for example, which is also tracked the same way, or a mutual fund or an ETF, either unfairly aided by or unfairly punished by the investment decisions of their investors. Now, for example, one of the things that we do when we vet an institutional separate account manager is we ask them, have you lost any major accounts recently? So let's say you're a manager with, you know, that manages $1 billion, but they had a $200 million account leave. Well, obviously that's going to have a material effect on their performance, and it would be unfair for us to penalize them because, you know, some defined benefit pension plan in the state of California decided, okay, we're out of here. So that makes sense. That's why time-weighted return is the way it is. That's the return that you might see when you see it on the news or on the internet and that kind of thing. However, what clients want to know is, how did I do? And that's called dollar-weighted return, or another word for that, and you've probably seen this, is internal rate of return. Now, that one really affects the performance that you actually get, and that's what you want to know. You don't want to know what some abstract either manager's return is or the index. You want to know, I put this money in, it's worth X now, how did I do? And that's what dollar-weighted or internal rate of return does. Now, besides this fundamental difference between how managers and indices report performance, has to do with something that we've seen over the years with our clients, and that is clients tend to forget why they pull money out of their portfolios. And if you pull money out, for example, when the market is down, that's going to have an effect on the overall performance of your portfolio. And you'll see it on your monthly statements, and you'll see it on the reports that we generate for you that are internal rate of return reports. But why do people take money out? Well, for all kinds of very good reasons, none of which are designed to maximize your portfolio's performance. Examples are, oh, I need to buy a new house or a vacation home, or I'm about ready to retire and I want to buy an RV, or you might have to pay, you know, tuition to a private school for your kids to go to high school or college or graduate school. You may have to take a required minimum distribution from your IRA or an annuity. All of those decisions have a lot to do with what the money that we invest for you is designed to do, which is to help you live your life and help your family. And none of those, really, the primary reason for that is, you know, to manage your life, but it isn't to design the best portfolio performance over time. So here are some examples of the kinds of things that we've had clients take money out, and that, you know, I would encourage you to think about in your own life in terms of what, you know, what you want your money to do. So for example, to meet living expenses, I got to eat. To repair a roof or remodel a kitchen or a bathroom, or put money down to buy a house or pay off your mortgage, or, as I mentioned before, pay private school or college tuition, to pay off a student or another loan, to buy a new car or a truck, to invest in a business or a real estate opportunity. Here's one, to pay your income, real estate or other taxes. I mean, all of these things have to do with living your life, and none of them have to do with maximizing your portfolio's performance. And yet clients tend to forget that. So when you're looking at these kinds of things, just remember that our job is to provide you with the money to live the life that you deserve and envision. Other examples are capturing tax losses to minimize income taxes, or to buy a boat or a mortgage slip, or to pay for your daughter or son's wedding, or take a vacation. And sometimes, you know, money coming in is you received an inheritance, et cetera. So, or helping a parent, you know, with a deposit to a retirement home or a facility. So my basic point here is that there's a lot of reasons why your portfolio's performance and what you see on your monthly statements doesn't necessarily match the performance of the S&P over a given period of time. Another profound difference, and this is massive, has to do with whether the stock market index, in this case the S&P, is including or presuming that dividends are reinvested, that the dividends of the stocks in the index are being reinvested in the index. And that's a very common thing for people to have as their assumptions. It isn't necessarily what people do with their actual portfolios, that we like dividends reinvestment, but it has an enormous difference and effect. A number of years ago, we looked at the hypothetical investment in American funds, which has been around, the Investment Company of America, been around since 1934. And the investment of $10,000 in 1934 would grow to, say, $2.6 million. This is through 2017, and we can get you the most recent figures, grew to $2.6 million, which is a return of about 7%. But with dividends reinvested instead of $2 million, it grew to $60 million. And that's just the S&P. So the point is that dividends reinvestment is another reason why, when you look at those figures, it may not be the best thing to do. Finally, and this is an important thing, stock indices were not designed to be portfolios, and an awful lot of airtime and groupthink is about, oh, you know, you should invest in the index. No, David Blitzer is the person in charge of the S&P itself, has always said that this was not designed to be a portfolio. And yet so many people are saying, just give me the portfolio return, just give me the index return. And that's a very simple answer, but the problem is there's a lot of risk associated with that index that I don't think you want, and most of our clients are not comfortable with. You know, is index investing the right approach? And, you know, it's a generic point, but first of all, let's start with the fact that David Blitzer, who retired in 2019 after years and years of being the head of the S&P selection committee that selected the 500 stocks that are in the index, basically has said famously that this was not designed to be a portfolio. And there are lots of reasons for this. First of all, common sense tells you, you know, how much diversification do you really need? Now, there's something called systematic risk, which is the inherent risk of the market by itself. And mathematically, you really only need about 25 stocks to diversify away from the systematic risk of the market itself. So why would you need 500 stocks if you only need 25? The other part of it is that, you know, if you have 500 stocks, the performance of any particular one stock may not have much of an effect. However, in the case of the S&P 500, because it's a cap-weighted index, a very few number of stocks have a profound effect on it. So it'd be one thing if the S&P 500 were equally weighted, but it's not, just like the Dow is not equally weighted. So that's another point. The other thing to keep in mind is that, you know, there's a joke in our business, you know, is it diversification or diversification? Common sense will tell you, why would you want the bottom four quintiles, meaning the bottom 80% of the stock market, and not just the top 20%, which would be 100 stocks? Because all you're going to do by adding those bottom stocks to your portfolio is increase risk and reduce return. So that's another reason why maybe one should question the whole idea of give me the index return. Now, there's some other significant problems with the concentration risk associated with market cap weighted indices like the S&P 500. So for example, as of June 30th, 2023, now they call it the Magnificent Seven: Apple, Microsoft, Amazon, Tesla, NVIDIA, Meta, which is Facebook, and Alphabet, which is Google, made up 24% of the S&P 500 and 44, almost 45% of the NASDAQ 100 index. So seven stocks represents a quarter. That means the other 493 represents the remaining 76%. That's not exactly well-balanced or well-diversified. But more important than that is the concentration of the return of those seven stocks with respect to the overall index return. So for example, in the first half of the year, the Magnificent Seven contributed 12.74% of the S&P's return in the first half of the year of 18.3%. So seven stocks determined two-thirds of the return of the S&P. In addition, when you look at it for the NASDAQ, it accounted for 25% of the index, 35%, which is 72% of those returns. So, I mean, those are some significant structural problems with the index, which I think is important to keep in mind. Now, you know, John Bogle, very famous guy, very rich guy, created Vanguard, appealed to our nature as human beings for what goes back to the famous Greek philosopher Occam. And his point was called Occam's razor, which is the simplest solution is often the best. Not in this case, in my opinion. So what does that mean? Just give me the index return. John Bogle built a huge empire with Vanguard by simply saying, active managers don't add alpha, so therefore just give me the index return. And I mean, it's a behemoth. It's a battleship. The problem is that you also have a problem with respect to the risk associated with that return, and nobody talks about that. So he knew that people would say, they're going to throw their hands up and go, I don't know what to pick, and I don't know whether this manager is adding alpha or that manager isn't or whatever. Now, if you break down the argument, the passive argument, it goes like this. And I've been lecturing at Stanford twice a year for 25 years, and I famously talk about this issue all the time. So the way that the passive proponents structure this argument, you know, there's no way that facts collide with their preconceptions. First, they start out by saying active managers don't add alpha, which means risk-adjusted excess return over the index. Well, the fact is that that's simplistic and it's not true. Half of them don't, which means, of course, half of them do. So active managers don't add alpha. And then if you say, if you can show them, there are managers that do, the half that do add alpha, then they say, well, then it's luck and not skill, okay? And then if you can show that it isn't luck and it is skill, and they create what's called active share, then they say, well, then it's not persistent. And then if you can show that it's not only skill and not luck, but it's persistent, then they say you can't find them. Now, I did a study in the beginning of 2012, looking back, starting in January of 1998. And the reason I started it there is because that was the beginning of the dot-com boom, going all the way through the end of 2011. And I asked my analyst, I said, all right, give me the 10 largest actively managed U.S. mutual funds, which were all large cap, whether it's large cap core, large cap growth, large cap value. And then give me the 10 largest passive funds and let me know whether they, you know, and how they did. And then which group outperformed which net of fees. You know, the biggest argument that a guy like John Bogle and all the proponents of passive investors talk about is fees. Well, which group do you think outperformed which? And the reason I picked that period is that you had the dot-com boom, then you had the dot bomb boom, which was the dot-bomb busts, from 2000 to 2002. And then you had the recovery, and then you had the credit crisis, and then you had the recovery after that. Well, the answer turned out to be active by 306 basis points per year, or 3.06% per year net of fees. And that's a problem. So for the last decade, the opposite has been the case. And so the way the passive argument folks construct their argument, say, well, see, gee, we outperformed for the last 10 years, so this argument is over. Not so fast, my friend, because there is ample evidence of cyclicality of periods of time when active outperforms passive and passive outperforms active. But, you know, I also think that people are not asking the right question. So, for example, let's take the half and half, the half of active managers that do at alpha and the half that don't, and ask a different question. Ask this question: how good are the best ideas of the poor performing half of the managers that don't add alpha, that drag their performance down from out beating the index to just meeting the index or slightly underperforming? Or another way to ask that question is, what is the cost of a manager's compliance with an index? In other words, keeping a high, what's called a high R squared, low tracking error. These are, you know, technical terms, but the point is, how good must their best ideas be such that complying with the benchmark drags their performance down to alpha? Now, bottom line for us is we don't care about meeting an index. It's sort of the famous story of the three Florida investors who were asked, you know, how their performance is doing. One says, well, I'm slightly outperforming the index. Another one is saying, I'm slightly underperforming the index. And the third retiree says, my money has allowed me to retire here. That's the point, folks. It's not about beating an index. It's about, is your money available to do for you the things that it needs to do, like we cited in the last segment, like paying taxes or sending your kid to college or paying for a wedding? So this last segment, I really want to just talk about, where are we now and where do we stand in terms of the Fed and a soft landing versus a major recession, et cetera. So where I think we are now is I think the Fed can navigate a soft landing. History and data point to a soft landing. The U.S. economy grew at a faster pace than anybody expected over, you know, on a year-to-date basis. Now, it's not all sanguine. Earnings are not so pretty. If you look at some of the major revenues by the S&P, they're down significantly. For example, energy earnings are down 51% on a year-over-year basis. And that makes sense because oil was much higher 12 months ago. And we'll get back to the oil price and the possible impact of that on inflation and what the Fed may do. Materials are down 28%. Healthcare is down 27%. The S&P in total at the end of the second quarter versus a year ago is down only 5.2%. So that's not bad, but not everything is negative. On the upside, consumer discretion and services are up a whopping 52%. Communications are up 18. Industrials are up 12. This is the third quarter in a row of earnings declines. So that's significant. The picture in technology is mixed. Apple is down, and where sales fell for the third quarter in a row, which is quite amazing. Microsoft is the only tech company called it in the tech sector that's up, and that's continued to do very well. Google and Alphabet, which are not considered technology but are in communication services, also did very well. Now, the S&P currently is recovering some of the losses it experienced in 2022 when it was down 19.4%. Now, the way I look at it is the S&P right now is expensive on any 1, 3, 5 year forward-looking basis, in my estimation. The NASDAQ is up 33% year to date, which is important because it dropped 33% last year. One of the things that we pay attention to is the spread between growth and value. So for example, last week, value was down 1.7%, but growth was down 2.82%. So the question is value still a bargain versus growth? And, you know, there's no question that the S&P being up the way it is so far this year is a little bit unanticipated because growth may be ahead of itself. Some of that has to do with how much large cap growth was hammered last year, particularly the Magnificent Seven itself. And we talked about that earlier in the show. So does that mean that we should just ignore growth and buy value? Nope. You need both. But if you're making a decision about how to allocate dollars, you might consider buying more dollars in value stocks because they're a better buy relative to growth stocks, which I think are a little bit ahead of itself. So what makes the most sense right now? The data shows that we're in for a soft landing. Let me explain what I mean by that. The usual expansion or bull market lasts 40 months when you look at it over the last 40 years. However, as inflation came down after peaking in the early 80s, I might add at like 13.8% 2 years before I got in the business in 1983, and then it came down in 1990s and beyond, what we found is that expansions tended to last longer. So for example, from 1982 to 1990, the average expansion lasted nearly 100 months. From 91 to 2001, it was 120 months. And from 2009 through 2020, it was 126 months. Thus, the average length is getting longer. It's averaging 8.6 years. Now, we had a much longer expansion if you consider going back to 2009 of like 14 years before we had that contraction last year. Well, why is that? Well, recessions haven't been as deep as and wide if the Fed is getting done what they need to get done, which is to push down inflation. So, for example, the bottom line, when the Fed started raising rates in 1984 and 1994, they triggered economic recessions, but they were more minor as long as the labor market was not severely impacted and the supply side of the economy hung on. So I kind of look at where we are right now as a kind of a Goldilocks situation. We could continue to see inflation come down while the labor market continues to be relatively tight, which it is right now. I mean, current unemployment rate is 3.5%, and 4% is considered full employment. In particular, when you look at the labor market, concentrate on the ages between 25 and 54, and right now, that group is at an all-time high of 84%, meaning 84% of the people in the workforce between ages 25 and 54 have jobs. So now job growth may slow a bit, but we can handle a softer recession based on that. The more people work, the more productive we are. So the labor market is telling us things that things are really okay. And while we still don't have enough people to fill those open jobs. Inflation is already falling. Money supply is falling rapidly. So the question is, can the Fed engineer the remaining reduction in inflation without triggering a recession? I believe so. Why? Well, labor first. When people are gainfully employed, they will continue to spend to support the economy. And don't forget that the US economy is 70% determined by consumer spending. Now, if corporations start to lay off people significantly, then we might start talking about a major recession. Currently, that just isn't what the picture looks like today. We have 9 million jobs available and only 3 million people looking for them. So I don't think the economy is hot. I think the stock market is relatively expensive right now because interest rates have gone up off the bottom and interest rates are higher. I think the bond market right now is ripe for extending maturities and locking in longer term rates higher than we've been able to do certainly over the last 5 to 7 years and even before that. So this is a good time, for example, if you have a lot of short-term bond funds and that kind of thing to look to extend maturities, maybe out 5, 7, or 10 years. In addition, don't forget that if a short-term CD or a short-term bond looks really attractive and maybe it's paying, you know, 4 or 5%, you have what's called reinvestment risk. So let's say you lock in something for a year at 5% and then a year from now rates have dropped. You won't be able to get that 5% when you go to reinvest that. I think it's probably better to buy a bond out say 7 to 10 years, and you get the 5 or 6%. And a year from now, if rates are down, you still have that bond. And in fact, if you bought that bond, it's gone up in value because the bond market overall has dropped. Now, the other major thing is wages. Wages is the biggest issue. The question is, will the rate of increase revert to the mean, to a normal level, which is about a 2% annual increase, once this whole situation normalizes? Will wages come down? Well, let's take a look at the December employment report versus July. Mining construction is still pushing higher at 5% in July versus December, but trade is still above 4%. In December of last year, information tech was 7%, but now it's about half of that at 3.5% increases in wages. Leisure was over 6, now it's around 5. Education was 4, now it's down to 3. Overall, average of all sectors is still 4.5%, not the desired 2%, but those increases are starting to come down. So if this trend in labor increases, I believe it will make sense to extend maturities in your bond portfolio, presuming that rates could come down. Now, I mentioned that we could have a hard landing, and that might have to do with oil prices, because if oil goes up, and it has, so crude oil is up 18%, diesel is up 33%, jet fuel is up 40%, and gasoline is up 19%. If that continues, then the Fed is going to be forced to hike rates in September, causing increased unemployment and increasing the likelihood of a major recession. Now, Saudi Arabia and Russia want higher prices, but the rest of the world can do something to resist this. So I think it's time to take some profits in stocks and take a look at some bonds. Well, that about wraps it up for me. Thanks for tuning in. If you have more questions or want to hear more about our perspective on things, I invite you to visit our website at opus111group.com. In particular, go to the Learn page where you'll find written and video and audio blogs that you can take advantage of. Anyway, thanks for tuning in. Have a great Saturday, and we'll see you next time.
Join us again next Saturday morning at this same time for the financial insight, opinion, and perspective of money management with Opus 111's Mike Mayo. Have a question or comment? Email us at info@opus111group.com or visit our website, opus111group.com. Sections of this radio show contain forward-looking statements that are not guarantees of future performance. This information is from sources we believe to be reliable. However, we cannot guarantee that it is accurate or complete. These comments are for informational purposes only and should not be construed as investment advice, nor as a recommendation to buy or sell any security or investment product mentioned in this show. Investing involves risks, and past performance is not indicative of future results. Individual circumstances do vary. Please consult an investment professional prior to making any investment decisions.